Okay, so if that's okay with everybody, we'll maybe make a start at this Ulster Medical Society meeting, which is the second and last one of this strange year. We had one 2 weeks ago online, which was actually very successful. So we're having another one this evening. So our speaker tonight is Dr. Stephen Boyd, but just before we start, I will do a few house rules just to make sure. So everybody should be able to see the screen at the moment and should be able to hear. Whenever we start, if you're not muted already, I would be grateful if you would mute yourself, and you might want to put your camera off. Questions can be asked at the end, and at that point you can unmute yourself, put your camera on again, wave at us, or just ask a question, put your hands up. You can also put questions in the chat, and I'll keep an eye out for all of that. So hopefully when we get to the end we will have a bit of discussion. Also, can I ask you, we sort of can see an attendance list, but we'd really like to get a record. So can I ask anybody who attends tonight to send an email to Cathy at the Ulster Medical Society website, because that's the best way of us having a record who was here. And hopefully we will, well, there's Cathy actually coming in now. We will send out a CPD certificate to anyone, so they'll get their CPD points. So that's the sort of house rules. So now I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight. So it is my great pleasure to introduce tonight Dr. Stephen Boyd. Stephen is a haematology registrar, but very soon to be a consultant. But Stephen, unlike many of us, has actually had a life outside medicine and haematology. He came late to medicine, and he worked for some years as a civil servant in London. But on the way, he developed lots of interests. He's very modest about them, but he ended up that he was actually giving gallery lectures in the British Museum on the subject of Egyptology. So I think, despite his protestations, he is quite an expert in this area. And I know he gives a very good talk on this, and I asked him to come along tonight to give this talk, which he has titled Ramblings of an Amateur Egyptologist. So, Stephen, over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor McMullen. So I chose the title quite deliberately because I suppose ramblings can have positive and negative connotations, but hopefully it's going to be more of a nice meander through looking at some sites and enjoying the journey rather than trying to get to a destination. And amateur has positive and negative connotations. I suppose hopefully it'll be from the original French, meaning lover, so lover of Egyptology, and maybe hopefully less of the more 19th century pejorative terms of like dabbler or and dilettante. But that's for you to decide. So in putting this talk together, I shuffled the slides and put things in different orders so many times over the last week and a half, because I was trying to think of why am I talking about Egyptology? Why am I interested in Egyptology? And I suppose it sort of goes back many, many years to, being very young and reading about all these myths and legends about gods and goddesses and pharaohs and everything. And so that sort of takes me to what has remained sort of the core of my interest in Egyptology and in the ancient world in general. And that's sort of the concept of the story. So if we think of human civilization going back, so ever since we've been social, we've told each other stories. We can look at sort of cave paintings. This one's from Brazil from about 20,000 years ago. Not sure what the story's trying to say, but it shows that early humanity and every eon since has told each other stories about their past, about the future, and just fanciful tales. Back in classical Greece, the rhapsodes wandered the lands, you know, telling the stories, the epic poems, the ones that survived the Iliad, the Odyssey, but I'm sure there were others that that other stories that were told that haven't quite survived down to the modern age. The theatre, this is the wonderful theatre at Epidaurus, which is one of the few surviving original Greek theatres from the 5th century BC, which was the height of the Greek tragedians and comedians. And, you know, although we can't go there at the minute, in non-COVID times, every summer, the Festival of Epidaurus still presented, you know, theatre, classical Greek theatre in the original classical Greek for audiences in this beautiful environment. So, you know, it's a place to visit and a place to see. And, you know, we see the stories from a past which connect us to that past in a more emotive and emotional way, I think, than, you know, any number of facts or numbers or dates, which I'm not as fond of, can. And coming forwards, we've even, theatre has continued throughout history. We've even rebuilt old theatres, like the Globe, reconstructed on the banks of the Thames. Then, obviously, stories progressed into cinema, more recently, some Netflix. And obviously, there's been stories in the forms of books. Whether these stories are histories or fiction, fact, or, you know, whimsy, from the old manuscripts copied laboriously by scribes, you know, invention of the printing press. But I suppose we have to remember, I guess, that for the vast majority of human history, most people have not been literate. And until sort of mass publications, there wasn't the access to the books. So this sort of concept of visual and oral history is probably the predominant until, you know, the last few centuries. So thinking about that as a concept, and I'm diverting a little bit from Egypt, but what is history? And I sort of, when I was thinking of this question, I thought, let's go back to the earliest historians, the, you know, people who are identified as having invented history. So a little bit of historiography. And the fellow at the top is Herodotus, and he's often titled the father of history. Less generous people would call him the father of lies for reasons we'll get to in a second. And then the fellow below is Thucydides. Both of these are Greeks, both living in the 5th century. Herodotus from Halicarnassus, which was a Greek colony in what is modern-day southern Turkey. And Thucydides, who was an Athenian. And their approaches to history were dramatically different. Herodotus was first, but in many ways he's more of a modern historian. And when I say modern, I'm talking the last 20, 30, 40 years, because his book does read very much like a book of stories. You can imagine him sitting down with a bunch of friends chatting these stories over, because he tells the stories from the perspective of the people he spoke to, and the things he saw. And he has a very balanced, almost anthropological approach to history and the reporting of history. Probably the best example that I can recall is the story he tells of the Asodanese people. They lived east of Scythia, which probably is somewhere in modern-day Siberia. It's hard to be exact. But they had a cultural tradition of cannibalism, of eating their elders. It wasn't they went around murdering people and eating them. It was a part of their society to, you know, whenever their elder died, the family got together, and to celebrate their life, they ate their family member. This was quite abhorrent to the Greek people, as it is to us. But Herodotus was very balanced, because the response of the Asodanese people to being told that other civilizations buried or cremated their relatives was as shocking to them as the idea of cannibalism is to us. So that's an example of, you know, how, you know, different perspectives can be presented in history. And that's probably more of a history that I'm interested in, where society sort of took a what was probably the predominant approach to history for over thousands of years. He wrote very specifically about a war, the Peloponnesian War. He was presented everything very factually. He didn't quote any sources, and everything read very convincingly. So when you read his history, it all sounds very logical and formed, whereas Herodotus seems sort of all over the place. And they both have their strengths and weaknesses, but it's just an illustration that, you know, when we're looking back at the past, A lot of what we see or what we tell each other or the lessons we learn depend an awful lot on, you know, our own experience, the approach we're taking, what we're trying to achieve, obviously our own hopes, expectations, prejudices, all these things are a factor of history. So history is definitely not fact. There's a lot of interpretation, but it remains extremely valuable. Looking at the past is enjoyable and also enlightening about us as human beings. And I think a little earlier I mentioned that, you know, one of Herodotus's titles, other than Father of History, was Father of Lies. So there are certain inaccuracies in his book. And just reading this little extract from the second book, he's describing an animal here, four-footed with cloven hooves like cattle, blunt nose with a horse's mane, visible tusks, a horse's tail and voice, big as the biggest bull. Their hide is so thick that when dried, spear shafts are made of it. I'm not sure what animal you're thinking of there. As a little hint, book two of Herodotus deals with Egypt. He had the very ambitious target in a very short space of describing the entire history of all about 300 pharaohs that throughout Egyptian history. He didn't quite manage that, but he gave it a go. So what he was describing there is this particular animal. You know, some aspects maybe, but there's no real mane on a hippopotamus. And if we look, obviously, at the Greek word hippopotamus, we see perhaps where he was coming from. So literally it means river horse. So that has led people to question whether Herodotus ever actually saw a hippopotamus as he claimed. But obviously we can never, maybe perhaps thousands of years ago, hippos have manes. I don't know. So before I get into the sort of core part of the presentation, which is telling a few stories, really, I'll start with a more traditional approach. We can have a little look at Egypt. This is a modern Egypt from obviously a satellite, and we can see that the borders are sort of written out or are sort of prescribed here in very light color, and they're very well prescribed. Probably that's not how the Egyptians, in fact, we're pretty confident that that's not how the Egyptians saw Egypt. That would probably be more of what the Egyptians saw Egypt as, the habitable area around the Nile, the land that they called Kemet, the Black Land. You know, it was called the Black Land because up until the construction of the Aswan Dam, every year the Nile would flood, and the flooded waters would carry fresh sediment down, and that fresh sediment spread across the land, and it would kept the area in the Nile as a really, really fertile area, and the Nile inundation, as they called it, supported life in Egypt. And in years where the inundation failed, for whatever reason, life was very difficult for the Egyptians. The desert, which is included in the official portion of Egypt, it was called Deshmet, that's the red land, and very few people lived there. Obviously, there are some nomadic tribes, but generally, that small area around the Nile is what the Egyptians thought of as Egypt. So, as again, I'm not terribly fond of dates, but I'll do a quick run through, because one of the most exciting things about Egypt, if we think, is it's a civilization that survived with recognizable motifs, language, culture for about 3,000 years, really. About 3,000 BC is where we sort of dynastic Egypt started. There's evidence of the sort of pre-dynastic phases. These were not literate phases. They didn't record their history on walls or in temples or in tombs or in artifacts. All we really have from that period are some flint, some shaped stones, tools. So there's not an awful lot we can tell about that period. But the early dynastic period was this little picture at the bottom here is a sort of engraving of one of the early pharaohs, Narmer. And he's in a very classical Egyptian pharaoh pose. And there's this man down here who's grabbing by the hair, and he's about to bash his head in, because that's what pharaohs do. Looking at the picture, we can see that he's wearing the white crown of Egypt, which represents Upper Egypt. Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt are a very important concept in Egyptian history. Upper Egypt refers to upstream, upriver, so it's in the south of Egypt, and Lower Egypt is downstream of the Nile, so in northern Egypt. And he's wearing the white crown headjet, which represents Upper Egypt. I'll have a little picture of both the crowns together in full colour later. So basically, this is the pharaoh smiting what is clearly in Egyptian iconography. If you look at enough pictures, this is a foreigner. Based on the style, it looks as if he's from the east or northeast of Egypt. At that time, the Egyptians really only identify four different types of foreigners: those that came from the north, the southeast, and the west. The east they call the Asiatics. South, the Nubians, the west, the Libyans, and the north, the sort of the expression changed over time. Later on, you have had something like the Greeks or the Romans, but the sort of the Mediterraneans, really. So this is a classic pose of Pharaoh establishing the early dynastic reign of pharaohs. So following the early dynastic period, we have the Old Kingdom, and that's when ancient Egypt really began to form as a cohesive entity. Unification of Upper and Lower Egypt, construction of the pyramids happened there. This is the Great Pyramid at Giza. There are other pyramids just over the hill at Saqqara, including the Bent Pyramid, where obviously they were learning how to make pyramids, and so the angle started off all wrong, and they had to adjust halfway up. And that probably is the most convincing reason why aliens did not build the pyramids. It was a hard-won process by innovative and hard-working people. So the Old Kingdom, as I say, the pharaohs built their tombs in pyramids. Didn't last much beyond the Old Kingdom, because pyramids not only are expensive, but there are also giant adverts for "please rob the tomb which is right here." And so after this period, they tended to move towards underground tombs, although that wasn't entirely successful or at all successful in hiding them from thieves. So although I say that there's a sort of continuity in Egyptian history, starting quite early on, there are breaks in that continuity. So the first intermediate period was a period where there was chaos, likely initiated by a foreign invasion, probably from the Nubians to the south, where modern Ethiopia, Eritrea is. And during that sort of about 150-year period, there were about 120 different pharaohs that ruled. You really probably couldn't call yourself a pharaoh in ancient Egypt until you truly had united Upper and Lower Egypt. That concept, that idea, is very much focal in what it is to be a pharaoh. If you don't control both parts of Egypt, then you aren't truly a pharaoh. And during this sort of the intermediate periods, there often was a pharaoh for Upper and a pharaoh for Lower. And so they wouldn't really have been truly considered pharaohs, from their descendants looking back would not probably have considered that quite proper. So following the first intermediate period, there was a consolidation, again, a unification of Egypt, Upper and Lower Egypt, into the Middle Kingdom. The Middle Kingdom is an interesting phase. There are certain transitions, as I say, from pyramids to underground tombs. A lot of the writings, which had been quite limited in the Old Kingdom, because a lot of the temples don't survive intact. The temples that perhaps were told the stories of the Old Kingdom were repurposed by later pharaohs. So that really the only literature that really survives that we can genuinely see from the Old Kingdom are the pyramid texts, which I'll have discuss a little bit later. So the Middle Kingdom, a lot of their coffin texts, there was some surviving papyrus, just because Egypt is such a dry place. Anywhere else, papyrus would have decayed. The coffin text, and there was a developing theme. The pharaoh was a living god, had been established long ago, and that continued to be refined throughout the Middle Kingdom. And it was at this point during the Middle Kingdom that the hieroglyphic language sort of reached its sort of its apex. So at that point, it became fixed. Prior to that, there were certain evolutions and progressions in language, as you'd expect with any natural language. But this was sort of the point at which that froze, and further Egyptian hieroglyph were fixed into Middle Egyptian. And that's the sort of language we learn if you go and do some courses in hieroglyphs. You learn Middle Egyptian because that is the majority of text that survives. Albeit that it was still very an elite text, given its context and how few people could actually read it, even in ancient Egypt. Then we come to the second intermediate, another breakdown, slight breakdown in order, but again, the general themes of divine kingship, the gods, the goddesses, the temples, all the beliefs that hold a civilization together, hold a people together, remained. And it was recreated in the New Kingdom. And the New Kingdoms were a lot of our evidence for ancient Egypt comes from. Most of the famous pharaohs, Ramses, the multiple Ramses, Amenhotep the Third, you may or may not have heard of him, he's my favourite pharaoh, and Tutankhamun, we've all heard of because of the accidental survival of his tomb, which is a sort of an illustration. And the fact that we've heard of Tutankhamun, a pharaoh who didn't rule for very long, is very much by accident. We wouldn't have heard of him if his tomb hadn't survived intact with all the materials inside, whereas all the other tombs that have ever been discovered had all been robbed. So this New Kingdom was at the height, really, of ancient Egyptian power. The picture down the left side there is the temple at Deir el-Bahari, mortuary temple of Hatshepsut. She's very interesting because she's one of the very few female pharaohs, although if you see any of her images and iconography, she has the same iconography as any of the other male pharaohs, the little fake beard and the headdress. It's very much the same. And we'll come back probably to a lot more to do with the New Kingdom shortly. And then the third intermediate period, another slight breakdown, and then it was restored briefly for the late period up until the conquest of Egypt by the Greeks under Cambyses. Cambyses, the Greeks didn't keep Egypt for very long. It was subsequently conquered by the Persians, then conquered by Alexander the Great. And then following Alexander the Great's death, his general Ptolemy went back to Egypt and established the Ptolemaic dynasty. And in many ways, the Ptolemaic dynasty behaved exactly like the Egyptian dynasties, the pharaohs of old. They assumed divine kingship, they followed the same rituals and the same gods, albeit they integrated the Greek pantheon and the Egyptian pantheon together, with all gods being associated with each other, Zeus being associated with the god of moon. And then it was really the Roman conquest during the reign of the last, probably true, Egyptian pharaoh, albeit of Greek descent, Cleopatra. What we recognise as Egypt was never re-established following that point. So I had mentioned a little bit that although ancient Egypt, the Pharaonic dynasties, had never really been established, old myths, old legends, they don't just die and go away. So this is the Temple of Hathor at Dendera. This Hathor is a goddess we'll come back to in a minute, but she's a goddess of motherhood, of childbirth. And even to this day, despite obviously Egypt being an Islamic country, obviously very different religion than the polytheistic Egyptian pantheon, women who have difficulty conceiving still to this day visit the Temple of Hathor at Dendera, to some of the pools there that were sacred to that goddess, to try to help them get pregnant. So even though obviously they don't believe in the goddess Hathor, some old beliefs, old traditions, old thoughts just don't die. This can survive for thousands of years, often passed down orally through families, even if officially something is gone. So, as I said, my real fascination with ancient Egypt comes with the stories. So I thought it was about time I told a story. This is my favourite one. Anyone who's seen any of my presentations before will probably recognise this because I like it. So we'll start a story a long, long time ago. back when Ra was getting quite old in his time on Earth and had ascended to the heavens. And the peoples of the Earth, however, were getting a little bit bored with Ra and were talking about revolt against the sun god. So Ra, obviously being a deity, was furious at this idea that these mortals would try to succeed from him. And so he had a clever idea to call one of the eyes of Ra, Hathor, who we've mentioned before, and commanded her to go and smite these pesky mortals and teach them a lesson. As we already mentioned, Hathor is generally more of a nurturing goddess, but Ra insisted, and so off Hathor went down to Earth to do his bidding. So, reasons I don't quite understand, all these people were gathered in the desert, possibly at a festival, potentially, my theory is that maybe the Egyptians invented Tai Chi. That's got no real evidence for it. And she set about doing what Ra had told her and smiting all these pesky mortals that had mocked and tried to revolt against the sun god. And in doing so, she transformed into Sekhmet. Now, Sekhmet is, my favourite goddess for a variety of reasons. But she's the goddess whose name literally translated is She Who Is Powerful. She's obviously a lion-headed goddess. The sun disk and the Uraeus above her heads shows that she's a sun god, because often they're sort of differentiated into sun and moon associations. And the Uraeus there, little snake, indicates that she's a daughter and eye of Ra, so an instrument of his wrath. So because polytheistic religions, historically ancient religions, often like to have a sense of balance, she's the goddess of often war or destruction, pestilence, but she's also, to balance that up, the goddess of healing. That which she can cause, she can cure, and that's sort of demonstrated in her iconography. In her right hand, in most of the iconography, she holds a staff. In her left hand, she holds an ankh, representing her power to her power to destroy and her power to heal and create. So she continued her job in smiting all the people, and Ra was a little bit perturbed, because obviously if there are no people on Earth, who was going to worship him and do what he said? So he came up with a bright idea, and because he noted that Sekhmet had become bloodthirsty, he took some beer and sort of dyed it with red ochre and to look like blood. And sure enough, Sekhmet saw this, and being the bloodthirsty deity that she was in her wrath, consumed what she thought was blood, but unfortunately there were a few side effects, and she was rendered to the point where she could no longer destroy humanity. And that is obviously why we're all still here, and why there wasn't an apocalypse all that time ago. So where did that story come from? This is sort of interesting, because this story comes from one of the, we call it books, even though it wasn't physically a bound book, and the Book of the Heavenly Cow, which is one of the texts that's inscribed in New Kingdom tombs. This is a sort of an illustration. There are multiple versions. This illustration is from that of Seti I, one of the New Kingdom pharaohs, and it doesn't quite tell the same version of the story that I've just told you. That's just my favourite version. There are multiple slightly different versions. These tombs in the Valley of the Kings and the Valley of the Queens are covered in these stories, these pictures. Here is one of the earliest types of earliest stories, the Amduat. It's a story that tells this. It's divided into 12 sections covering the 12 hours of night, and it tells the story of the sun god as he traverses the underworld during the night time. So the Egyptians believed that whenever the sun set in the west, the sun god entered the underworld, traversed it overnight, battling demons and monsters, and then arose triumphant in the east in the morning. You can tell that the sun god is in the underworld in this image, because in iconography in ancient Egypt, at least during the New Kingdom, the sun god, when during the day, is represented as having a hawk head, much like the god Horus, but in the underworld he is represented as having a ram's head. So this is a solar barge, and he's sailing through the underworld, fighting off all the monsters that would threaten the people. And because obviously the pharaoh was strongly associated with the sun god, this would represent to people that the pharaoh was there to protect and protect the people, and obviously without them they'd be terribly doomed. This is another common illustration. It's the Book of Days. We can tell this is a different, slightly different version. It's where the sun god's barge is traversing the sun during the sky during the daytime. This lady up here is the goddess Nut, who is the sky, quite literally. And similarly, there is also a Book of Nights, but that tells a very similar story to the Amduat. Then there's the Book of Earth. And again, if we have a little peek at, you could probably guess where the sun god is in this particular, if we look at this little section. Hopefully you can see the arrow. He's got a little ram's head, so we know that at this point, the sun god is again in the underworld. And we see here the snake, which is the monster Apophis, who wants to devour the sun and end the world. There seems to be a theme in ancient mythology about serpents devouring the sun to end the world. So those were the illustrations, the stories on the walls of the tombs in the New Kingdom. Going a bit further back, this is the pyramid texts. There's not as many pictures, but there's still stories, there's still spells to allow the transition of the pharaoh from the living world to the afterlife. And so this was found inside this particular pyramid. I use, obviously has seen better days, but there are there are very few inscriptions actually within Khufu's pyramid, which is the largest on the Giza plateau. So it's generally some of the other pyramids where you get the pyramid texts. And then, as I say, during the Middle Kingdom, there were the coffin texts, where most of the work was on the wooden coffins. And it was at this stage where things started to shift between only the pharaoh gets to have an afterlife, to some other people get the afterlife, obviously, if they have the means to have a tomb constructed to be mummified. And this is just the scene of the weighing of the heart ceremony, where Anubis weighs the heart of the deceased against the feather of the goddess Maat, who's basically a goddess of universal harmony. And if the heart weighed no more than the feather, they were allowed into the afterlife. Otherwise, this lovely little fellow here would eat them. So before I move on to just discuss the crown of Egypt, this was the interesting things about all of these texts, all of these illustrations, is that they were put inside tombs. And really, the pharaohs didn't want visitors to their tombs, because anyone who visited their tombs seemed to steal their stuff. So the question is, although a lot of it is about displaying the power of the gods in relation to the pharaoh, it's hard to know who the audience was supposed to be. It seems to convey a certain idea that these illustrations were done in the genuine belief that they would empower the pharaoh into the afterlife. A lot of people look back on history and see visual representations and say that this represents something that they're trying to convey to their people. But that's very difficult to say for the tombs, because no one was meant to be there. Obviously, as a tourist in modern times, you can go and visit them, but that was not their purpose. Their purpose was a lasting and eternal resting place for the physical body of the pharaoh. So this seems to suggest that, at least for this particular aspect of the stories and the spells, that the imagery was really because of a belief that in doing all this ritual and creating all these beautiful works of art, really, that were hidden away for thousands of years, that the pharaoh would transcend death to live as a god in the afterlife. And I say that may not be the case for a few things we discussed later. One example is the symbolism of certain very common and prevalent artifacts in ancient Egypt. So here we have basically the crown that the pharaoh wore. We have this, in the middle here, we've got the white crown, the hejet, and then the red crown, the deshret. Strangely enough, deshret's the same word they use for the red land, where people didn't tend to live in Egypt. So the white crown here represents Upper Egypt, so in the south, and the red crown represents Lower Egypt in the north. And in wearing this crown, the pharaoh was symbolizing what became very early on in early dynastic Egypt the defining characteristic of what it was to be a true pharaoh, and that was that you had united the two lands of Egypt into one. The two lands of Egypt were viewed separately, but as an two important components to a whole, and which had to be maintained and preserved and protected. So the sort of the crown wasn't simply a crown saying, "Look, I am the king." It's a representing saying to the people, "Look, I am the pharaoh. I've united the two lands, and I am the protector of the two lands." So obviously, you know, I have a legitimate right to rule over you. This illustration also has a similar message. If you know a little bit about the iconography, this also is focusing on the importance of the pharaoh in uniting and keeping together the two lands. This little symbol here, the little T with a little funny heart shape at the bottom, that's the symbol, a hieroglyph that which translates quite literally as unite. And you see the two plants here. These are two different plants, sort of a woven tied around this symbol of Sma. One is the papyrus, and the other are the lotus, which were the symbols, the sort of floral plant symbols of Upper and Lower Egypt. And this sort of iconography, which we'll see later again, is also saying. And this is obviously an inscription at the bottom of a statue, because you can see a leg here on the left. So this was for public display, and this is saying, you know, here is the pharaoh uniting the two lands, and sort of you can see that he's physically tied the two lands together. These two representing the two aspects of the pharaoh. On his head, the same flowers, the same plants are represented. So this is saying, here I am. I'm keeping the place together, protecting you from all those terrible foreigners. I'm good for you. So keep listening to what I say. And you know, again, that is where the pharaoh was ruling in the world, very physically, advertising in a very practical fashion what they were doing for people, and that was reinforced sort of in the associations between the pharaoh and their gods. So the concept of divine rule was very literal back in ancient Egypt. We all know that divine rule in the concept of English history and Henry VIII and the head of the church, that was a very different thing. That was a representative of God. This very literally, in the ancient Egyptian sense, was that the pharaoh in life was this fellow on the left, the god Horus. So he was the living Horus, and on death and transition to the afterlife, he became the god Osiris, who is basically the god of the afterlife. So, you know, in life, the pharaoh was Horus, and in death, the pharaoh became Osiris. So strongly associating and reinforcing this link that the pharaoh had not only practical benefits of keeping the place together and protecting the people, but also had the divine right as living gods to rule over Egypt. And there's a very interesting story about how Osiris became god of the dead, but it's not family friendly. There's apparently, according to ancient Egypt, if you lost your phallus, say it was eaten by a crocodile after your brother had cut you up into little pieces, as Set had done to Osiris, you couldn't come back into the world of the living, so you had to go and rule the dead. But because of, obviously, this is a family friendly, I didn't turn that into an animation. So I'm going to come to a few of the pharaohs that ruled during the New Kingdom. This image on the left represents someone you may or may not recognize, probably not. It's Amenhotep III. And on the right is an image you probably do recognize, which is Tutankhamun. They were quite closely related. Tutankhamun was Amenhotep III's grandson. But it's interesting that a lot of people have heard of Tutankhamun, and you know, not that many people necessarily have heard of Amenhotep III, despite the fact that Amenhotep III ruled for over 40 years during sort of the probably the highest point in Egypt. He constructed so many temples. Egypt was at the height of its power. It was peaceful, other than a very brief a battle with the Nubians during his fifth regnal year. Whereas Tutankhamun did not live very long, unfortunately, and did not rule for very long. So this, again, shows that a lot of what history is to us is what has survived. What has been passed down to us is what we know. And things we can't possibly know are potentially as interesting, but unfortunately a lot of that's lost and we have to piece it all together. So looking at those two pharaohs, if this is a schematic of the tomb of Amenhotep III, it is quite a large and complex, elaborate construct. Down here in the bottom is where his sarcophagus was kept. And then by comparison, despite being more famous, this is the tiddly tiny tomb of Tutankhamun. A lot of this obviously had to do with the fact that Amenhotep lived so long. And what tended to happen with these tombs in the Valley of the Kings is they were started once the pharaoh became pharaoh, and they stopped being constructed as soon as they died. So generally there's a very close correlation between how old the pharaoh got and how big their tomb is. But it's also an indication, obviously, of how important the pharaoh was in many ways, although it's not something that was advertised to the people at the time. It's only something that's been clear to us because we wander around exploring tombs. So I've mentioned Amenhotep III. There's another image of him there on the left. Very much classically represented, as all pharaohs are represented, sort of physically fit and well, wearing the kilt, wearing the crown of Egypt and the uraeus, the cobra, representing them as a representative of the sun god Ra, and with that little beard on there that, you know, probably wasn't something they grew, but was probably something they stuck on. Certainly it wasn't the case of Queen Hatshepsut. And then we've mentioned, obviously, Amenhotep and his grandson, Tutankhamun, but in between those two, there's the fellow on the right. He was originally Amenhotep IV, but renamed himself Akhenaten. And you may have heard of Akhenaten because he's quite unusual in the terms of the pharaohs. He basically abolished, which shows the power of the pharaoh, the entire pantheon of Egyptian gods, and started to worship a single god, the sun disk Aten. He is quite unusual in other ways because you can obviously see that the physical form here is quite different from the perfection on the left, but it's still very stylized. There's no evidence he actually looked like this. He still is lots of the paraphernalia of the pharaoh. You see that he's holding the flail, and the crook over here is broken down, so he's definitely still smiting the foreigners in defense of the Egyptian people, as was required by the pharaohs. But, you know, the imagery there is dramatically different from any of the imagery shown for any of the other pharaohs. And again, that's shown in this this representation of the sun disk, the Aten, the single god, feeding the pharaoh on the left, Akhenaten, and his queen Nefertiti, who had the famous bust. So obviously she was represented quite differently. So when I say bust, I mean obviously the bust of her head, and that's kept in the Louvre for lack of confusion there. She is represented very differently in different art forms. This change, this move of from multiple gods to single god, and the movement of the capital from Thebes, where modern-day Luxor is, to Amarna, which is east of that in the desert, didn't last beyond beyond Akhenaten's lifetime. His son Tutankhamun restored everything back to the way it had been before. So now I'm coming back a little bit through circles to Sekhmet. We've told the story of how Sekhmet came to be, at least in myth. And these are some of the statues. I'm sure anyone who's ever been to any museum with any sort of Egyptian collection can probably remember seeing statues something like this around. And these were the talks I gave in the British Museum often revolved around these particular statues because they're very ubiquitous. There's lots of them sitting all around the British Museum because there are some estimates, but there were approximately 750 statues of Sekhmet built by Amenhotep III during his reign. And these are not small statues. These are enormous statues. They're taller than these statues are. If you're standing next to them, your head would probably come to somewhere around the shoulder. So they weigh many tons. They're made of granodiorite. That is quite a hard stone. It's a phaneretic igneous rock. So the phaneretic means that you can, if you look very closely, you can see that there are visible grains. And the igneous just means it was formed from cooled magma. And it's predominantly of quartz and feldspar. And the colour itself, the very black colour, is very important in Egypt. As I mentioned before, the fertile part of the Nile was called Kemet, and the stone itself, the granodiorite, was also called Kemet, and that sort of associated this sort of statue with the life-giving powers of the Nile. So it's very strange because we have probably about 360 statues standing as the ones on the outside here, and about 360 sitting. Although we can't be entirely sure about the precise numbers, because for a long period of time, obviously things were taken out of Egypt without any records necessarily existing, but there are a lot of them around the world, and it's really interesting. What really interests me about this is, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into building 700 enormous statues out of a very hard rock. That, in theory, the bronze tools that the Egyptians were using at the time would not have been sufficiently hard enough for them to cut or engrave this stone. So there's a certain mystery surrounding how the stone was cut and how it was made. So there's obviously some evidence missing that would link to us. There are lots of theories that the wood was cut by originally into the blocks by sticking in wooden wedges and then wetting the wedges so that the wood expanded, and in doing so cracking the rock. And then there was some suggestion that hardened other rocks were used for the carving rather than the bronze tools that were widely available at the time. But they're obviously works of art, and you know, they were found originally, the majority of them, in two places: in the Temple of Karnak, which is on the east bank of the Nile at ancient Thebes, which is modern-day Luxor, and at Amenhotep III's mortuary temple. So they were found, a lot of them in the mortuary temple were found buried, so a lot of them weren't actually displayed. And although we know that they were constructed during the reign of Amenhotep III, quite a lot of the statues have slightly edited hieroglyphs to replace Amenhotep's name with a later pharaoh. Ramses II was famous for crossing other people's names off monuments and putting his own name on, which maybe he had some sort of self-esteem issue. It's hard to know. So looking a little bit closer at one of the statues of Sekhmet, so we can see, if we're looking at it, that there's quite a lot of detail on. There's obviously the sun disk at the top, the Uraeus. Obviously, she's a lion-head goddess. We've got them, but it's a little bit bizarre because they've got a mane. So even though she's obviously a female, being a goddess, they tend to like putting a mane around her. In her hand, she has the ankh. She doesn't, in this particular statue, have the staff, which she does in the standing statues. The sitting statue seemed to represent her more benign form as the goddess of healing. And down the side we see there are some hieroglyphs inscribed. Now, not all of these statues were obviously finished by the time Amenhotep III died, because some are found in different stages of development, because what happened was the general shape was formed first, then the decorations on the head and the dress were put on next, and only lastly were the hieroglyphs and then the illustrations on the side. So this little, on the top right, you see an illustration of what the side of the statue shows on each side. And we see again this motif we've seen before, the symbol Sma, this T with a heart at the bottom, with the lotus and the papyrus entwined about it, sort of associating the Amenhotep with the unification of Egypt. And down the side, I've had a look at the hieroglyphs. So here we see what's written on the left-hand side, and I've just changed, although on the statue it's up and down, I've just changed it left-right so that we can, because we read from the left to the right. The interesting thing about the hieroglyphs was that it's a language that could be written and read from either the left to the right to the left, or top to bottom. If you look at the, for example, any of the faces, so whatever direction, say, if something is written horizontally, whatever way the face is looking is where you is the direction you start reading from. So if the face were looking the other way, you start reading from right to left. But in this case, the face is looking over to the left, so you start on the left. So these are my own translations. So they aren't terribly elegant, but it's always, I suppose, the difficulty with translation is that it's about trying to capture accuracy, but trying to get a little bit of fluency into the language, because if you do a very literal translation, it doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. So here on the left is written, "Good God, who is strong and vigilant of head and arm, Lord Neb-Mat-Ra," and that's one of the names of Amenhotep III, "beloved of Sekhmet, who smites the Nubians, given life." And then on the right-hand side, we have written, "Son of Ra, who justly rules Upper Egypt, arising in splendor, Lord Amenhotep, ruler of Thebes, beloved of Sekhmet, who smites the Nubians, given life." And some of those phrases don't necessarily make sense. Given life, whenever you're talking about the pharaoh, at the end of the sentence, these two hieroglyphs are always there, and that translates into given life, because in honor of the pharaoh. The names of the pharaoh are always surrounded in these cartouches. Names of gods are never represented in cartouches, and you know, arising in splendor is a common sort of phrase that you see in hieroglyphs. I suppose if you think about sort of any sort of stylized language like hieroglyphs, or any stylized form, say like the epic poems attributed to Homer, they have a lot of repetitive phrases in them, largely to allow the people who are reciting them to remember. But in these sort of representations, there's also forms that you have. So arising in splendor is commonly placed prior to the name of a pharaoh, just like given life. And we can see obviously here that smiting the Nubians is obviously a popular pastime. Of all the foreign peoples that the Egyptians contended with, the Nubians to the south were probably the ones that caused them the most trouble, that probably invaded them the most frequently, and during certain of the intermediate periods actually ruled parts of Egypt. So there was a particular dislike between the Egyptians and the Nubians, and that is very clear in a lot of the inscriptions, because they're smiting Nubians left, right and centre. I suppose we couldn't really talk about hieroglyphs without a very brief mention of this stone, which is very famous, the Rosetta Stone. So it's actually a rather interesting proclamation. Well, it's not a terribly exciting proclamation, but it's a proclamation by one of the Ptolemaic pharaohs, that he was pharaoh and was now the living god. The reason, obviously, it could be used as a way of turning what had for thousands and thousands of years been a mystery. One of the reasons I think that Egyptian iconography, Egyptian language, Egyptian culture remains so important throughout thousands of years of history is the mystery that surrounded it, because up until the 19th century, no one could read Egyptian hieroglyphs. No one knew what they said. And so people imagined all sorts of things, that if they could decipher these hieroglyphs, they could learn the secrets of eternal life, that sort of thing. There was lots of mysticism going around that was very popular, particularly in the 19th century. So this allowed, over quite a long period of time, by a lot of very clever people, to come up with a way to read hieroglyphs. The top is inscribed in hieroglyphs. The middle section is inscribed in the cursive form of the Egyptian language, sometimes called demonic, other times called heraldic. And then the bottom is written in Greek, classical Greek. So obviously people have known how to read classical Greek for some time. So using this, despite it being broken, somehow these smart individuals managed to interpret the hieroglyphs and learn how to read them, which gave us a lot more information on on how the Egyptians lived, at least how the pharaohs and the rulers of Egypt wanted to convey the life and times of that particular pharaoh. We've all seen that previous one, this hieratic, this cursive script, because as I mentioned, hieroglyphs cure. The hieroglyphic language came to a stop during Middle Egyptian times and remained static, largely as a ceremonial language for temples and sometimes important treaties or declarations, as on the Rosetta Stone. But even those people who were literate didn't spend their time writing letters, inscribing very, very careful pictograms. That would have taken forever. So hieratic was, like I say, the cursive form of Egyptian. And you see that some simple hieroglyphs remained in demotic / hieratic. That little zigzag is a hieroglyph. So they kept some aspects and simplified others that were much more difficult to draw. This is the remnant of a pot shard. So if you think back to ancient Egyptian times, paper didn't exist. Papyrus wasn't that common. It was only really accessible to temples, to scribes, to pharaohs. So what people who were fortunate enough to be literate used to write little notes to each other on were little bits of broken pot. And this was a little bit of broken pot that was found in Deir al-Medina. This was a very small sort of village on the west bank of the Nile at Thebes. And this is important because, obviously not everyone could read and write, but this was the village where the workers and the very skilled craftspeople who built the tombs of the pharaohs and the tombs of the queens lived. And so a lot of these pottery shards with little bits of hieratic have been found in this village. And it gives us, the hieratic gives us much more of an idea of what the people did on a day-to-day basis, which historically people weren't very interested in, but over the last 30, 40, 50 years or so, the very personal histories of people who weren't famous, who weren't considered important, have sort of become much more interest to historians. And so these little shopping lists, these little notes from husband to wife or other way around, give us an insight into how they lived. And we'll come now to this gentleman. He's called Jack Janssen. And the reason I'm coming to him following hieratic is he was one of the foremost experts on hieratic. And he did a lot of work on the village of Deir al-Medina, the craftsperson's village. And I had the very good fortune to meet him because one of the my teachers in Egyptology when I was learning it, and was his wife, who was also a very eminent Egyptologist, Rosalind Janssen. And the reason I'm highlighting Jack Janssen is not just because he was an expert in hieratic, and so he wrote a lot of books about things that maybe a lot of people weren't interested in. He had an entire book about the importance of donkeys in ancient Egypt, which is wonderful. Both he and Rosalind have written a book on getting old and aging in ancient Egypt, which isn't something you can read on a tomb. You can't read it on a temple wall. and also little bits about other things. So, but his story in itself is fascinating. He was born in the Netherlands in 1922, and at the age of 17, obviously, the Second World War started. And because he was Jewish, whenever the Nazis invaded the Netherlands, like many people, he was hidden in an attic by, friendly people who wanted to protect him. And obviously, the most famous of these people is Anne Frank, whose diaries have survived. But he prior to this, he hadn't really decided what he was going to do with his life, and perhaps hadn't really even considered necessarily Egyptology. But one of the very few books he had in the attic with him at that time was Alan Gardner's seminal work on Egyptian grammar. The first edition was published in 1927, and Alan Gardner was very interesting because the last edition of his book that he was involved in, he kept going right up to the end. It was published the year he died in 1963. So Jack Jansen, during a sort of one of the most horrible, frightening times of his life, learned the hieroglyphic language as probably the only thing to occupy his time. But then as his interest progressed, he progressed to become one of the very, very few people in the world that could read fluently the hieratic language, because whereas there maybe are hundreds of people who can fluently read Egyptian hieroglyphs, there are only tens of people who can fluently read and interpret hieratic, just because of the relative importance placed on those two things, the grand, impressive hieroglyphs, compared to the humble but equally important hieratic. And those are some of the books that they published on everyday things, like furniture at Deir el-Medina, the dress, household animals, grain transport, and it's like getting old in ancient Egypt. So if you want, say, whilst no one can visit Egypt, to have a little look at the tombs that these craftspeople from Deir el-Medina built, the Theban Mapping Project is a good website. What they've done is they've got I think you saw the little plans I had earlier of the tombs in Egypt. Those plans came from the Theban Mapping Project. And for each tomb, they have a listing where you can see a plan of the tomb and photographs of different sections of the tomb. And it's a nice thing that you can go through all the different bits or just find the pharaohs you're interested in most to explore. So that's the end of my talk. And I suppose what's interesting is why on earth did Amenhotep III build all these statues? And I can't tell you an answer right now. There are lots of theories. There are theories that there was some sort of terrible pestilence raging through the kingdom at the time, or perhaps Amenhotep himself was unwell. And so in order to appease Sekhmet, who would have been thought to have sent that pestilence, he built a lot of them. There are other theories surrounding the number of statues. There are about, enough of the standing statues for each day of the year, 365. And again, same number of the sitting statues. Is there some sort of solar inference, some sort of calendar event? But my plan at some point when I maybe retire in a few hundred years' time is to have a little look into this in more detail. My plan for my dotage is to travel the world and catalogue these statues, take a record of what is written on them, translate these areas to try to come up with my own idea of what's going on. But that is still a few years away, and I've taken up quite enough of your time. So thank you very much for listening.
So Stephen, thank you very much. That was absolutely wonderful. I'm sure you would be happy to take some questions and discussion. So has anybody any questions they'd like to kick off with? There has been somebody putting comments in the conversation as we go along. Shane McKee, at least. Has anybody any questions they would like to ask? Just wave or shout out or raise your hand. Shane, go ahead.
I'm going to go ahead. Sorry, I'm a bit dark here. Stephen, that was great. The one thing I was wondering about, what's your opinion of the medical capabilities of the ancient Egyptians? I know we didn't really touch too much on that, but there's a huge amount. Imagine you'd go on all day, yeah.
You could, but I suppose in summary, I think there was very little evidence. They had a fantastic grasp of anatomy. They had to perform mummification, but there's no real evidence that they associated any of that anatomy with any physiology. So they didn't really quite link things together terribly well. There's not a lot of evidence they did much other than employ spells and rituals and appeals to gods in terms of treating illnesses. Or at least there's not, I suppose that's the thing about looking at this, there's not evidence surviving. Because I imagine that practical things like that aren't the sort of things that would make them make their way onto the walls of temples or the walls of tombs. They're probably the sort of things that would have been on papyrus. And papyrus, although some has survived, quite a lot of it hasn't, just because it's a very fragile medium. And the only reason any of it survived was obviously because of the arid environment in the desert. And you know, as time's gone on, a lot more things have been destroyed by that as well, because I didn't mention it, but us going and visiting the tombs in the Valley of the Kings and the Queens is really destroying the tombs. What was a perfectly lovely, completely dark, completely dry atmosphere in the tombs, which meant that the beautiful pigments on the walls are full beautiful colour. People going in day and out, them taking flash photography, sweating all over the place, getting the place humid, is sort of destroying what remains. So it's hard to know, but my suspicion is there's no real evidence they had a good grasp of medicine, despite their excellent grasp of anatomy.
Anybody else like to ask a question? I see way back Patrick Morrison was telling us about hippopotami. And Eamon Mackle, would you like to comment?
No, I've no interest in commenting. I'm just saying that the Ebers Medical Papyrus, I can't even spell papyrus, never mind prescriptions, give 33 prescriptions for treatment of anal rectal diseases, which are probably equally as successful as many of the Middle Ages versions that we used in more recent times.
Yes. There's been a lot of prescriptions for many things throughout history, and many of them would never probably never have done much good. But there is some small surviving evidence, but there's not a lot for success. I think the Egyptians were really well placed if they had made some links to be able to practice medicine quite well. But this was their prescriptions that they came up with weren't terribly convincing, at least none of the ones that we know of. Maybe they were geniuses and we just have what we need just isn't there.
I'm interested in the iconography and that lady who felt she had to have a fake beard.
Hatshepsut, yes.
I haven't actually had the pleasure of being in Egypt, but I have been to the Nubian pyramids in Sudan, and it was pointed out to me there by someone who'd been to both that the iconography is very different, that the Nubian ladies all have curly hair, whereas the Egyptians have all straight hair.
Women in the iconography are presented as women with generally long straight hair. The exception being if you happened to be in a position of rulership, which Hatshepsut was. Some people would argue that she was not legitimately pharaoh; she was the regent for her son. And there are some people who argue that very, very dramatically, that make you wonder a little bit about. But the thing is with Hatshepsut, maybe whether she was officially pharaoh or not, she did feel the need to represent herself as all previous pharaohs with the exception of Akhenaten, felt the need to. And even he kept some of the iconography. He still kept the beard. He still kept the uraeus, the flail and the crook. But she felt the need to represent herself as Pharaoh by using those same symbols that demonstrate that she was Pharaoh. And that little beard bit seems to be a very important one. But she was a really successful Pharaoh. The mortuary temple is really impressive. There's a point above it. There's a little walk, which you can do. Well, maybe not now, but I have done at one point, where you can walk between Deir al-Medina, the village, and over the ridge, that little cliff behind Deir al-Bahri, the mortuary temple of Hatshepsut, down into the Valley of the Kings. And that's you get a beautiful view of what all the things she has constructed. And the things she constructed were actually really good quality. Some of the more famous pharaohs, like Ramses, some of his monuments are a little bit ramshackle, the ones that he really built, not the ones he claimed to have built by crossing someone's name out.
Okay. So many, many fascinating stories. Anybody else like to ask anything or comment? It's a little bit limiting when we're all looking at a screen. But I think what we did get out of that is this: the things you were pointing out on the slides, actually looking at them on the screen, we probably were able to see better than if it had been on a big screen in a lecture theatre. Don't know. Okay. So if nobody else has any comments or questions, I really like to thank you again, Stephen Boyd, for such a fantastic lecture. And I mean, it's just wonderful to hear something so much separate from what we do during the day. And your breadth of knowledge is amazing.
There's too much to know. 2,000 years. I don't pretend to know. The things that interest me, I know, but obviously, like anyone, the things that interest me less, I don't know so much about. So I could go on for ages about certain things and have no clue about others.
Okay. So thank you very much. Lots of messages are coming in thanking you, because unfortunately we can't really give you a big round of applause, which is what we would normally do. So thank you, Stephen, again.